Welcome you all. Good evening. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Vikrampu, for a vibrant welcoming and introduction. No need for further Mangala Charan, that's all blessings have been invoked. So yeah, we are gathering today one more time, inviting each of us to contribute, to bring any topics, any inquiries, any explorations you may like to engage with. I personally really like this format. I also like to speak about specific topics like we did at the beginning of this year where we were studying grass, or more specifically, the third verse of Shikshastakam, which starts with a meditation on humility and grass. But also, I really appreciate just showing up vulnerably and inviting you to showing up vulnerably and bringing whatever topic is of your interest and maybe being caught by surprise by whatever you need to explore and invite for vulnerability. That's my point, no? This type of meetings, but there is no pre-planned, pre-scripted topic. It puts us in a type of liminal space where we are caught by surprise and we want surprise. We want holy unpredictability in a safe circle, somehow a little bit.
Just too sharp.
Yeah, it's a little, for at moments,
Sit there and
it
then
creates
just
some.
click into it.
Before it was okay. Maybe you put up the volume too much and just a little bit less. So, yes. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Thank you. So yeah, questions are very set, not only set the questioner on the quest, but even the so-called answerer. And both end up being explorers of whatever needs to be explored. So I always like to recall how the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam, one of our main books, every time a question is presented, the official speaker will take his time to praise the question and the questioner. I'm also reminded of at the time when Srila Prabhupada left from this world. Some of you may know at one point, some of his closest disciples asked him, "Okay, when you're no longer with us, is there anyone we could go to receive siksha to learn more?" He said, "My god brother Srila Siddhar Maharaj." So many of them went to him. And interestingly enough, Srila Siddhar Maharaj, of course, shared a wealth of knowledge and realization with them. But big part of what came through Srila Siddhar Maharaj was because of the questions that these disciples of Prabhupada were bringing, this healthy, sincere concern and willingness to serve deeply after the departure of their guru. And that's something that was noticed but by one of Srila Siddhar Maharaj's personal servants, basically, and his eventual successor, Bhakti Sundar Govinda Maharaj. He said at one point to these Prabhupada disciples, "I've been with Srila Siddhar Maharaj for my whole life. I've heard him speak so many things. But now that you are coming, he's speaking so many new things in a new level of depth and inspiration. I never heard that before." And that's all in part, it's because your questions, your sincerity of approach that's drawing from him a new level of wealth. So that's ideal pattern, right? It's not just that the speaker is enlightening the audience, but it's always a mutual reciprocity of nourishment and inspiration. Bodhayanta parasparam, Krishna says in the Gita. When my lovers get together, my aspirant lovers get together, they enlighten one another by their very presence. Sometimes it's not even a question. Sometimes a sincere presence and sincere showing up is enlightening. And to be sitting close to someone who has been truly honest in their journey, that in itself is a legacy, right? Maybe the person didn't open his her mouth during the whole meeting, but a sincere presence and a sincere bearing witness of that presence, that can be enlightening. That's what Sri Mahaprabhu talked when he really very much inspired Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, not to say fully transformed his heart. No? He just sat in front of this great scholar, and Sri Chaitanya was in silence for a week, just listening. But the quality of his presence was transforming for the other person. So, all this to say that you have a role to play into next meeting. And please don't put 100% of the responsibility on my shoulders, because that's not how it works. Even if I will take that 100%, it will be like a toxic, dysfunctional, disproportionate distribution of responsibility. We all want to learn to love, and love is the ultimate responsibility. So we all need to learn how to take responsibility. Responsibility, our ability to respond to life. Each of us are here today. We're responding to one another, whether with words, with glances, with movements, with presence. So increasing responsibility means that, how to increase my ability, my capacity to respond to what's coming today. That's it. Short introduction about what we are supposed to do here today. And not only today, hopefully, but every day of our lives. We are supposed to show up to one another in life, in relationship, with deep presence and willingness to learn and to enlighten mutually. So how can we live a life more blessed than that? So you're invited to share whatever you would like to share. It can be a question, it can be a doubt, it can be a topic you may like to express, it can be a thought, it can be something you feel the need to share, to express. I think just to know that we have, at least for me, it's the fact that I know that I have spaces where I can be myself and speak whatever I need to speak, that's liberating, right? And ultimately, that there are no taboo topics, but that everything can be brought to the table if it comes from a sincere place of aligning with the truth. Right? Today we're talking about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. One of my favorite one-liners of him will be, humility means perfect submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth, which doesn't mean we'll become violent or anything, but just like, so we were talking yesterday, I don't want to betray myself. So I have no sympathy for that. Doesn't mean that I'm, how do you say in English? Antipatico? Antipathic? What's the opposite of being sympathetic? Anyhow, you got my point. Yeah, you got my point, right? So humility means that. Humility, it means I submit myself to that which is true, to that which is real, whatever that may be at any given moment. And I'm willing to submit to that which is not true. As we were talking yesterday about so many masks that can get in the way of truthfulness. So from that spirit, we are invited to share today, participate today, and hopefully beyond today. But let's keep it at today, because we have nothing else but today, here and now. And the future depends on what we are doing. Our future in life depends on how we interact today in this room. Let's put it that way. This interaction will create the next moment when we leave the room. When we leave the room, we'll create the next, and so on and so forth. So let's take it seriously, guys. When we are doing this in the next 1 2 hours, can affect crucially our trajectory in eternity. Not to make anyone feel like too overwhelmed, but also not to just casually, oh yeah, another more meeting, one more lecture, let's see, the day after comes hopefully some person, and then we'll go back and life go, and we want to contact meaning and purpose in every moment. You're raising your hand. And he raised his hand before. So you are friends from
Even
for a
my
long time, so you can agree
peculiarities
who
were
goes first.
undeniably the girls. Go for it, Ralph. Right there.
Well, we were recently in the dam with, the Parikrama Mission, and this is a beautiful group of devotees. There were 25 of us. And one of the most striking things for me was that it wasn't just single sex, it was men and women together. And I felt that by associating with the females, it was very beneficial for my development. Because I'm a male, I've got a lot of male energy, and I felt that the feminine energy was super beneficial for my completeness in one sense. Whereas we generally see that we keep things very separate in our, institutions, and so yeah, I just wondered if you could talk about that, whether the feminine energy is suitable for me, or whether I'm just in complete illusion, or if you can elaborate on this topic.
You want my definitive diagnosis on you.
I'm not for it.
Title of this question is Ramachandra in Complete Delusion. That will be clickbait for sure. Maybe Badra can reply to this question because you asked similar questions some days ago, right? I mean, I'm sharing. So it's interesting because, I mean, she was not with us physically in the pilgrimage, but she brought a similar topic or a similar concern or a similar observation. So it seems to be current, right? In our life and society. So is Ramachandra Prabhu in complete delusion? I would say no. So well, let's begin there. There is
Thank
hope.
you.
There's hope for you.
Okay.
You know me, you know what I will say in reply to your sharing. But we'll say some words about it, of course. Especially as we were talking the other day, we touched upon that very briefly. And when we were giving our first sharing here in terms of making peace with the material energy. And trying to appreciate matter as a sacred, not only as a say as sacred stuff, but even in relational terms as our mother, Mother Nature, Mother Earth, Mother Matter. Matter comes from the word mother. So that's, I mean, na material nature is feminine. You call them, you don't call them Father Nature, Father Earth. It's mother. And everyone, if you say that, I've never heard someone say, "Why mother? Why not father?" Instinctively, we know. And as we say, we have a dysfunctional relationship with mom, we'll be messed up kids when we grow up. And in connection with matter, there's a connection with all that is connected to that department, our body, our emotions, our psychology, and the feminine department unto itself. No? Because if I despise matter, if I insult matter, again, as we tried to explain the other day, that's basically a form of Vaishnava aparat, right? And we were talking about our modern ecological crisis as a result of that. We could make the point, ecological crisis is a result of Vaishnava aparat to material energy. Vaishnavi aparat, more precisely. And many times when we don't have a very healthy conception of material nature, which is such a very powerful representative of the feminine, probably we will extend a similar dysfunctional template to all things female. And many times, no wonder, sometimes practitioners who are very much opposed to material energy, they don't know how to relate to the female department. In a healthy way. And by female department, I do not only mean woman, I also mean our feminine side as men, right? which for some men even it was previously unheard of or unthought of, like, oh, I have a feminine side. Oh, how do I get rid of that? It must be no. How to properly honor and integrate that? And the irony is greater in our Gaudiya tradition, right? Because I mean, we worship. Ultimately, we have God worshiping the goddess, right? Dehi Pada Palabhamudaram. Gita Govinda says Krishna is kneeling down at the feet of Sri Radha. That's a god we worship, a god who has someone else in his own altar, right? And who is in God's altar? The goddess, the ultimate embodiment of the feminine. So paradoxically, or ironically, we have this great emphasis on the goddess and Sri Radha and so on and so forth, but many times we see dysfunctional treatment of relationship with the feminine. And many times, as one of my mentors said, unconsciously, many religious groups unconsciously tend to emphasize worship of the goddess or the female divine as an unconscious way to counterbalance all the dysfunctional relationship they have with the female. It's like an unconscious way of trying to balance things. I've seen that in our movement. I've seen that in other traditions as well. So yeah, personally, of course, we have heard about probably too much, some of you, some of us, some cautionary tales about male-female interaction. But unfortunately, those things, of course, there's always potential danger in everything. I can relate in a very toxic way with anyone in potential, not necessarily with a female, with anyone. With a cat, with my mom, with my father, with you, with myself to begin with. But somehow or other, we end up, in some cases, not always, here we are, I'm not thinking about any particular person or group or institution, because we find beautiful things everywhere and we find dysfunctional things everywhere. So, but somehow or other, sometimes in certain cases, unfortunately, and of course I've talked about this with many feminine voices in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. I'm friends with many Vaishnavi elders or Prabhupada disciples and other, well, elder Vaishnavism. And yeah, that sometimes, I'm not saying we are there, all of us are still there, but they have told me a few tales from the old times that were scary, were surreal, were the assumption that, anyhow, you all know these old stories. And it's very much a scapegoating. No, it's like a way of, okay, we have unconsciously, you always, if you are not willing to confront your own unresolved stuff, many times humans and many times religious institutions end up scapegoating, creating some scapegoat. Someone is to blame for this. Right? Not me, of course. Me? No. So where to put the blame? Where to put the fall, the danger? And many times women have been there. Not in our movement, but throughout human history. And again, for me, it's a form of spiritual bypassing, unconscious scapegoating. So poor man, they have to be distant from ladies because they are very dangerous, right? We are so much in danger. I'm being sarcastic, just in case if you don't know me enough. Just so nobody's doing a clip, editing that, editing those 10 seconds. Like, here we have Swami Padmanabha's new stance. It's like, please. We spoke yesterday about a text out of context and the dangers of that. So, and again, the cautionary tales that even sometimes we find in scriptures are not about women in themselves, and are not about men. It's about seeing each other in a way that lends itself to exploitation, seeing each other in a way that is not wholesome, it's not sensitive, it's not empathic, it's not compassion, seeing each other as as an object, as a non-entity, a form of impersonalism, basically. If I see you as an object, I'm not seeing you as a person. So I'm being, in all practical consideration, I'm being impersonalist. Therefore, I'm contradicting the core of my teaching. So I personally think that it's very important that we gradually redeem and reclaim the feminine in all its forms, one of them being emphasizing that there, as we can speak about God in male terms, we can speak in God about God in female terms, and try to make that, when I write my books, still sometimes I refer to God as he, but I try to make this cautionary note in the beginning. I could write the whole book saying she. And at one point I thought, okay, I will write my books and I will say he at one paragraph and she at the other, but I thought it may be a little bit too much for the reader. But just to make the point, right? So I decided, well, I will clarify. I could be saying she all the time. And God is he and she, and beyond that, in ways beyond how we can see he and she also. But I think we need to get in touch with, yeah. I'm talking now from the male department, and men have in general have a hard work contacting their female side and being vulnerable and acknowledging weakness. Now that's basically by study and research, the greatest fear of a man is to be seen as weak. So many times men put on a mask of strength. I'm very powerful. I'm very strong. I'm invulnerable. Like if that will be like a desirable attribute. But if you pay close attention to, and I try to make that case in radical personalism, I begin the main section speaking of vulnerability, how we worship a vulnerable God. Krishna is pretty vulnerable. Even if you want to go to the male God, to the male side of the equation, Krishna is very vulnerable. He's very in contact with his emotions. He's very an integrated person, as God should be. Right? He doesn't have a problem crying in separation of Radha, acknowledging his needs, begging forgiveness when he messes it up in the Leela. Again, we cannot fully compare ourselves with Krishna, but my point is there is some point of reference there as well. So we are all invited to be vulnerable. Women also, right? I'm not, women can also become toxically masculinized, so to say, and that's not healthy either. So we have to keep both sides of the coin in a healthy way. So I personally, as we talked the other day when Badra brought a similar topic, it was basically a very similar topic, right? I've seen with my own eyes, and I remember some of the retreats we've done in the past, where, like as you referred to our recent retreat, there were men, there were women. I prefer to use the expression there were brothers and there were sisters. Because men and women still sounds like a label. Brothers and sisters still may be a label, but it invokes for me like family spirit and invokes the sense of we are all interconnected. Even if you don't have a clue who I am and I don't have a clue who you are, we are brothers and sisters. Because there's only one family, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, says the scriptures. There's only one family. Whether we acknowledge or not, that's another issue, but that's a fact. We are all interconnected. So I think it's important how to bring this one line where there's only one family, how to bring that line into practice and how we treat each other and how we relate to each other. And by this, of course, I'm not saying like and to invoke a very, I don't know, a mixture of everything and everyone without any form of discernment and in the name of we are all one family. But also not creating excessive walls or boundaries that are really not promoting this experience of we are one all one family. As much as there may be a potential danger in a connection between man and woman, there may be a potential beautiful connection between man and woman, and not necessarily on sensual, erotic terms. Or even in those, if that has to be the case, let that be also, of course. We're all a byproduct of that. I mean, that's a whole maybe separate conversation, sexuality and sex life. I'm not someone who particularly is against sex life. Of course, I'm a monk. I'm not engaging in biological sex life, but I mean, that's something sacred. Of course, it can be traumatized if you don't engage it from the proper place, but it's not something bad. In one sense, it's something miraculous, and we are all here because of that. No. We are all here having this nice meeting today because of the sexual life of our parents. Really? Right? I mean, to go to the fact, we shouldn't be embarrassed about it. We should be grateful for that. And by saying this, I'm not promoting toxic promiscuity. Promiscuity is anyway. One thing is, we don't need to take one thing to the to any extreme. We have to always find a balanced expression of all the things. So it doesn't mean that if I'm talking me as a sannyasi to a lady, I'm breaking my vows, or it's something very terrible is going to happen at any moment. If you are thinking like that, probably you have to examine what's going on in your own mind, right? Badra.
Can you just spark the memory of the story of the two sannyasis crossing the river? There's a woman who carries you across, and the other one who says, hours later, you shouldn't have carried that woman across the river. And the other one replied, I put her down on the other side of the river. You're the one still carrying her.
So stories like that try to point to this idea, right? Many times those who are like criticizing and pointing in very negative ways, it's just their own unresolved shadow playing itself out unconsciously, and again scapegoating someone outside because they don't have the capacity maybe of seeing that within themselves, huh? But I think yes, as not only as a movement but as individuals, we all need to reach a healthy place where we can relate to each other as sisters, brothers, family, without being like frozen or paranoid or neurotic about at any moment anything can happen. I mean, at any moment anything can happen with anyone, for that matter. But we cannot live life from that way. We have also to learn to trust each other and to learn to connect with each other even beyond gender, so to say. I mean, there is a soul in each one of you, and there is a wonderful soul. Krishna finds each one of you wonderful, and why we should deprive ourselves of the blessings and benefit of connecting with half of the earthlings, so to say. Well, as I told you the other day, and I thought, Blake, after some people may find this controversial, but I personally, as a sannyasi, I have friends who are female, and I dare to call them my friends. And I'm not having any illicit situation with them. It's just they are my friends. Why I can't do that? Of course, many people think different things. I remember when I did the first podcast with Nam Rasa Prabhu, it was tragicomical. We were starting the podcast, and he will say, oh, I'm bringing to the podcast my new friend, Padmanabha Swami. And he stops like, oh, Maharaj, can I call you my friend? Because someone once told me that sannyasis cannot have friends. And I was like, oof. Who told? I didn't ask who told you that, but I was like, if being a sannyasi implies not having friends, I'm leaving my sannyas right now. You follow me? At least for me. No, for me, sannyas doesn't mean being without relationships or not being able to connect with people in a friendly way.
Is it a misunderstanding of being like socially dead, the sannyas, when you take sannyas, you become socially dead? Is it like a misunderstanding of that?
I will say so, yeah. Because in one sense, the actual understanding, okay, I personally do not have a family in terms of me being a dad and having kids and a wife. So I've renounced that family. I mean, no need to do that. I've renounced that version of a family to accept Vasudeva Kutumbakam. I mean, I have nothing against that version of a family, but I'm not renouncing family life. I'm just trying to live a family life where all of you are my family. Right? So my family, there are brothers, sisters, friends, elders, juniors, and I want to participate from that place in the family. So it's not that it's like I'm rejecting everyone. I don't want to talk to anyone. I don't want to have connection, affection, friendship with anyone. That's to me sounds like a dysfunctional human being, basically. So we have to become divine and spiritual, but that includes, again, keeping in place our human sensibilities. You were raising your hand, Basanti. Yes.
I just wanted to ask that because you were saying that, it feels really natural for you to be connecting with women and
I didn't say it feels really natural, but
get the words right, but that it's a natural thing to do.
yeah.
But wouldn't you say that compared to the average person, you've kind of got your lust factor under control?
I wouldn't say that.
No.
I mean, there are degrees of control, but I wouldn't come here and say, hey guys, I have lost 108% under control. I wouldn't say that. But I wouldn't say that by talking to a lady from a sincere place, I'm being agitated or anything, because I have had that experience that that's not the case.
Yeah, just
Of course, I will take my measures not to. I won't be in a private island with myself with a lady, so to say. So it's not that you will see me like doing stuff like that, right? But for me, that's, I mean, that because I'm not absolutely transcendental to everything, then I won't talk to any of you ever, because there is potential danger. I think most probably that will trigger even more whatever I have not yet properly integrated. So for me, the way of transcending whatever needs to be transcended is not by rejection or by distance, but by learning to properly relate to it. So for me, transcending lust doesn't mean not talking anymore to any single woman on earth, but learning to relate to them in a healthy way, seeing them as sister, friends, mothers, in a healthy way. And naturally it becomes that the transcendence comes from that place. That's my idea of transcendence is not rejection, but integration. So it's working pretty well so far in my 25 years as a monk, and it's not that I'm showing credentials now here, but I have to talk from experience. And I'm not saying everyone should do like I'm doing. I'm just talking how it's working for me, and I can understand some other people may take another stance. But also another stance shouldn't be a stance that is clearly toxic or damaging or too much, you know? So, of course, each one has to be sincere about their own situation, but many times when these cautions come about association between men and women, potential for lust being increased and sensual desire and all that, again, in one sense, nothing of that is bad. We shouldn't say stigmatize any of that. There's a place for that. In the Vedas, you have Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, Prem also, of course. But there is a place for sense enjoyment. Of course, how each one expresses that and in their corresponding ashram and life, that's different. But I mean, if you are eating an ice cream and I come and start to stigmatize you eating an ice cream, that makes no sense. You're enjoying that ice cream, aren't you? Sense enjoyment. You're such a rascal. No more ice cream. That's So I mean, for some people we ask cream, for some people it's other, each one is in their own situation. So my point is, we have to be able to work with the tools we have and gradually integrate all the things. But I mean, I know people, and Prabhupada had that common sense, and people come to him and say, I can't stop drinking wine. Okay, no problem, keep drinking, offer the wine to Krishna. By saying this, I'm not promoting, guys, let's have a wine party after the program. I'm not drinking wine myself. I'm not saying that to justify my clandestine drinking of wine or anything, because that's not happening. But for some people, that's really impossible at that moment. So, okay, how to integrate that in a way that is healthy, and how to make yourself feel part. Maybe I'm going to another topic, but it's all related. How to make you feel part of the family? Still, there's only one universal family. It's not that because you have a problem with gancha or drinking or whatever, you don't belong, right? Krishna loves everyone unconditionally, so everyone belongs already. But sometimes we make it hard for some people to feel them part because there's a particular difficulty they have in their lives, and sometimes it's easier to be exclusivistic rather than inclusivistic. And inclusivistic doesn't mean no discernment and bring like a so serial killer into the ashram and then everything ends up in tragedy. I'm not saying that, but yeah, there are different drives, different tendencies in each of us, most of us probably in different degrees. And we cannot just press a button and expect everyone to be beyond all that. And for most people, that's a gradual process. And many times the gradual process is not about stopping doing all of those things. Some of those things maybe, but some other things, how to express that in a healthier way. Well, again, for me as a sannyasi, it doesn't mean like, okay, to be more and more, the more transcendental I am, the less I will be talking with ladies. Or the more harsh I will be in treating them, and the more strict I will be. I mean, I heard some, I won't go into the details of the most bizarre stories about how strict renunciants or monks will treat women. That was like from a horror movie or something. That was offensive. And no wonder after that, they have almost none of them could keep their vows, basically. So that spoke from where one is coming, right? Has nothing to do with the woman, but the woman was like a mirror triggering all things unresolved in your own self regarding related to the feminine side. Many times, not always, but many times it goes to the source relationship with one's mother. Many times I've seen that. Seen practitioners or people besides our tradition having a very complex, traumatized, dysfunctional relationship with females. Okay, I'm making it's a very, not always, I'm not giving here an absolute diagnosis, but many times you find a correlation with what's not resolved with mom. So, yeah, in my case, of course, nobody comes from an absolutely functional family, 108%, but I'm fortunate to say that, yeah, I have a pretty healthy relationship with my mom. Very, very nice mom. She's not watching, she doesn't speak English. So. And somehow that helped me a lot always, even before joining this movement, before being a monk, but it was always very natural for me to relate to ladies from a healthy place. I mean, to men, hopefully also. I hope you don't find me guys too dysfunctional. But yeah, I don't want to turn all this into the autobiography of Swami Padmanabha. But yeah, I think it's healthy to, and I witnessed that when we, again, not like, I mean, there's a very beautiful place for women to share with women and for men to share with men. Even in our sangha, we have groups, sisters, we call them sisterhoods and brotherhoods, and that's great and crucial. There's also for sharing in cross-pollination, so to say. Now, with healthy boundaries, of course. Again, nothing wild and crazy. but no wild and crazy walls either. And I can see there is nourishment and there is a sense of connection and a family, and I can see how all of that prevents from other types of disturbance coming into the people's minds with one another. Because there's a feeling of family, of safety, of protection, of support. So. What do you think, Ramachandran?
I think it's a wonderful perspective. I just felt that the feminine energy, I find, is very devotional and very giving, and there's a lot of compassion there. And to be on the receiving end of that, I mean, like my elders, Manjari and Ratanapriya, just to go to them, and suddenly they're just nourishing me with unconditional love. I mean, I was just a great honor and great, I'm super grateful for that. And I felt it was just very nourishing for my being, for my heart. Where, I haven't found that flood of devotion, that flood of love so prominent in my contacts with, the men in my life. It's there, of course. Tirupuram gives me a
Be
little
more
bit
loving,
of
Tribhupada. Why you are so like this? Probably his next question now changed, and he will have some question on that.
yes, I really appreciated your answer, Maharaj, and it was illuminating. Thank you.
Don't know. For me, it's kind of common sense, which sometimes is not the most common of our senses. But if one is in touch with it, one's own common sense and gut. You know how commonsensical is the connection with someone in a way that is safe and nourishing, and when you may be transgressing what is healthy. Sometimes we don't have that, of course, and in those cases we need to protect healthy boundaries. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but we shouldn't make the boundaries like the norm, but I'm trying to as much as we can to grow into relationships that are more and more wholesome. It may take time and it may be a lifetime project. I'm not saying next weekend all of you brothers, sisters, fully connected and all in harmony. Probably we are not in all of Vrindavan yet, so it may take some more time. But also not to be like fatalistic and say, no, that's not possible and that can never happen, so better not even to try it. So let's make a big distance. Keep the girls with the girls, the boys with the boys, and not two extremes of the pendulum. So how to find gradually a balance. And it may take time. And each case is different, of course, with some people that may be more natural, not with everyone else. We are not here to push, to force anything. Yes. Guys over there, you need the curtain down. You can move somewhere else if you want. I know what it means to have this. Yes. Yeah.
All right. Keep going. What's that?
Yeah.
That's as far as it goes. Long shorts.
Badra.
Something along a similar, kind of connected to what we've been just now discussing. I facilitate the learning of shlokas for some of the children in our homestead over there. And recently,
What's the recent one?
sorry,
What's the recent one?
the recent shloka,
The latest one, yeah.
the recent one is Upadeshamrita 1.
Okay.
By the way,
Don't expect the children to follow that to the rule at that
Yeah. They said vegan nachos with pasta. And so they've pretty much learned, they have definitely learned the Sanskrit and they've learned the English. Of course, yes, I know. I've told them at this age you don't really understand the import of this, but it's good that you learn it anyway. Learn, start the samskaras and understand it. And one of them, they're very intelligent kids, one of them asked a question. Krishna, why did Krishna give us these urges if he doesn't want us to, if it's a victory, to control them? And so I thought, wow, how do I. But then overnight, I got an answer. And the next day I presented it to them that it's not that Krishna, it's not that these urges are bad, it's just that the misuse of them is bad. We went into that. But I just thought you might be able to elaborate further on that. Right.
Go to the classroom, Upadeshamrita 1. I won't torture you making it memorize it now. That's Bhadra's role with the kids. I love memorizing slokas. It's a beautiful way to. Of course, I like how you say it in English. When you memorize something, you say learning it by heart. Though sometimes we learn it by head only. But the expression itself points to it's not just something to get it here, but learn it by heart, right? So as you say, as you intuit, none of these faculties, not because Bachovegam, the faculty of speech, Krishna, the verse is not saying stop speaking, right? Means you could say control the urge of the tongue. Doesn't mean stop speaking. So none of the things are meant to be canceled, the other begums, but just to be reoriented, right? Like when Rupa Goswami quotes, I'm getting old.
Sarvapari
No,
vinay
in relation to what we are talking. Oh, generally, I don't forget that verse. Nava bread grahyam indriyai sevon mukhehi jivados swayameva spurat yada. First
muktam.
line.
Tashya Krishna namami.
Thank you so much. I need the kickstart. So in that verse, it is said all these senses, all these faculties, cannot, through them, we cannot get Krishna, basically. You cannot contact, understand the absolute through the senses. But now, next, the verse is, but. Through all those senses, engage in seva, engage under the influence of bhakti, that's how you can contact Krishna. So the very same thing that is an obstacle can be a facilitator. It's all about how you use it. Like we were given the other day the example of a knife, right? A knife is there. If you are in your sane mind, you won't see a knife and think, oh, I can kill all of you today. No. But someone in not their same mind will go there probably. So with this knife, I can cut some vegetables and makes nourishing food for you. The knife is not one thing or the other, it's a knife. What we do with them. And the same with our emotions, as I remember mentioning in radical personalism. There's no such a thing as bad emotions. They are just bad things we do with our emotions. Emotions are. What you do with them, that can be good or bad. No. Anger is not a bad emotion. Again, one of the seven secondary rasas is Rodra rasa, anger for eternity. In the context of Leela, again, we should be careful not to compare. I will be angry for eternity. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying anger has a purpose. In the Leela is one thing, in our life here, maybe setting boundaries, expressing certain things. So yeah, these things are not in themselves bad things. We don't need to, as we're talking these days, we are not meant to reject anything. Bhakti is not about rejection. It's about learning to engage everything. Yukta vairagyam ucchate anasaktasya visayam yathartham upayunjata nirbandha krishna sambandhe yukta vairagyam ucchate prapanchikataya buddhya hari sambandhu vastuna mumukshu viparitya go phalgu vairagyam kathyate. Rupa Goswami says these two verses: what's real renunciation, what's false renunciation? Yukta vairagya, phalgu vairagya. Real renunciation means, and again, here comes the official definition of renunciation. You're expecting, now comes a long list of stuff I have to reject. And Rupa Goswami says, you have to learn to see everything in connection to Krishna. That's proper renunciation. That's it. So you are like, so what do I have to renounce then? You have to renounce not seeing everything in connection to Krishna. You have to reject what does not exist, basically. You have to reject illusion. You have to reject seeing things disconnected from each other, which is in itself something impossible. You have to reject the impossible. And you have to accept what is possible, what is obvious. By contrast, false renunciation, he says, implies rejecting a lot of things without seeing their connection with Krishna. So that's interesting. When he speaks about re renouncing and rejecting lots of things, he uses that when he's speaking about false renunciation. Real renunciation, he says, it's not about renouncing anything. It's about learning to see everything. Sambandha, Hari Sambandha, Krishna Sambandha. Everything is, one name of Krishna is Mukhya Sambandha. Mukhya means main principle. Sambandha means relationship. And Mukhya Sambandha means in relation to Krishna. He in relationship to whom everything has its primary connection. That center around which everything is orbiting. Everything. So if everything is revolving around that all attractive center, everything is connected to Krishna and everything is worthy of my love, ultimately. When Rupa Goswami describes bhakti, another verse for the kids, maybe they already know that one, and for the kids here also. Anyavilasita shunyam jnanakarmadinavritam anukulyena Krishna anushilanam bhaktirodha. So in this verse, Rupa Goswami says Krishna is the perfect object of love. And Jiva Goswami comments on that verse saying, because this is the definition of bhakti. So bhakti has as its object Krishna. And Jiva Goswami comments very quickly saying, a narrow definition of the object of bhakti is to say Krishna is the object of bhakti. A broader definition is to say the object of bhakti is Krishna plus everything that is in relationship with Krishna. And what is in relationship with Krishna? Everything. So he said that's a broader definition of bhakti, more encompassing. It's not just Krishna, I love you, but I hate all these other guys here. That's not bhakti. So of course, that's how maybe our bhakti begins. Again, as we talked the other day, me and God in the altar. Ki jai, dancing, singing, the altar closes. I don't know how to relate to anyone else. Please open the altar. I don't know what to do with these people here. They open, oh, Krishna, Haribo. Close the altar. God. I don't see Krishna here, but Krishna is everywhere, right? In every heart. Eventually, you grow Krishna not only in every heart, in every atom. Where is Krishna not present? So, Jiva Goswami says that a mature, broad-minded definition of bhakti is to love Krishna and to love everything in connection to Krishna, which is everything. So we have no reason not to love anything. I'm putting it negatively. We have no reason not to love anything. We have all reasons to love everything. In practice, it may be very difficult, but That's the definition of bhakti we are being given. So again, all this to say there, it's not about rejecting. So when Rupa Goswami speaks about tongue, speech, belly, this organ, that faculty, he's again inviting us to honor each of those dimensions by engaging them properly in Seva. It's not that, oh, I need to control those impulses means I have to stop eating, stop speaking, stop sleeping or doing all that as less as I can. Sometimes that's not functional. Krishna says in the Gita, sixth chapter, proper, again, speaking about yukta, he used the word yukta, yuktahara, viharasya, and so on. Yukta, 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 proper balance. You should not eat too little. You should not eat too much. You just eat what you need to eat. You should not sleep too little. You should not sleep too much. Try to sleep. What is healthy for you? There's no definitive number. For some people, healthy sleep will be certain number of hours. Healthy eating will be a certain amount in the place. Of course, sometimes we may eat a little bit more, a little bit less. But don't make that the rule, right? So try to be balanced. And what's balanced for every person is different. But we are not saying stop eating, stop sleeping, stop relating to people, stop talking, stop, 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 stop. No. Krishna consciousness is not about stop doing things or not doing things. That's why many times I cringe a little bit when I hear devotees being asked, okay, so what's your practice about? No meat eating, no sex, no drugs, no this, no that, no. So, okay, and what do you do? Do you do anything, or do you just don't do things? Right? Do you have any way of defining your life in positive terms? And for some people, it's hard. Somehow they have started with a no. And when you start with a no, many times another no follows. And I know, folks, and your whole life and practice is conceived in negative terms. What not to do, what to reject, what is bad. And many times the whole thing becomes very fear-oriented. There's danger at every moment. I have to reject, I have to be careful. And ultimately, that's not the type of love we want to develop. That's not how we want to relate to life, to God, to everyone. So gradually making it can begin that way. Again, I'm not condemning that. We may begin from a fear-driven orientation, but ideally, ours is not the path of fear. Ours is not even the path of rules and regulations, to be honest. Ours is the path of, as I like to call it, the path of fascination, not the path of regulation. Path of fascination. I'm so fascinated by this idea, this reality, that everything else falls into place by that fascination. Not that in the beginning, I may need to force myself to follow them, but eventually there has to be some rasa, some force that is driving me. And everything else accommodates following that fascination. Smarta vyasatam vishnur vishmarta vinajatuji, another shloka. Sarva bhiddini sedasur etayoretak eva kinkara. Basically says, become fascinated with Krishna. Always think of Krishna. Never forget him. Again, that can only happen if you're fascinated with Krishna. If you have not fallen in love with Krishna, if I tell you always think of Krishna, you cannot do it. After 5 seconds, you're already thinking about the laundry list and this and that. But if you're fascinated, you will find difficulty to stop thinking about the object of your fascination. That's what happened to the gopis, as we know. Once they sat all in circle, after having considerable headaches that Krishna gave them by not showing up on time for the night tryst or whatever, and this Krishna is a pretty crooked guy, and we are all day thinking about him. Maybe we should try stop thinking about him for a moment. Let's see if that creates some relief. So they all sat in circle like yogis. Like we try to sit and try to think about Krishna. So they try to sit and try to forget about Krishna. That's their counterintuitive yogic process. Right? Imagine if I invite you, let's guys sit in a circle and let's try to forget Krishna. You will be, no. I don't need to sit in a circle to do that. That's already happening very organically. How to be fascinated with him. But the gopis were so fascinated, so they were, let's try to forget him for a moment, because sometimes this puts us into trouble. So they make a very big effort, try to follow some rules and regulations to forget Krishna. Now, after a few seconds or after a few minutes, even they start to open their eyes and look at to each other, like, did it work? I wonder. They're too fascinated what to do. So this verse says that, right? Always think of Krishna, never forget him. Fall in love, become fascinated. All the other sarvabhi dini siddhi, all the rules and regulation, which is a whole universe of them throughout scripture, are to serve this principle. Period. So all the universe constellation of rules and regulations have to nourish your fascination, have to nourish your, as I said the other day, falling in love in an absolute way with the totality of reality. If the rules and regulations are not playing that role, probably that you are engaging with Rupa Goswami calls Niyamagraha. You are doing something without actually understanding why you are doing that. And that becomes an obstacle. Doesn't mean you should stop following the rules and break all rules and regulations and invoke sheer anarchy, but learn to know why you are doing what you are doing, not just doing it because I'm told to or because everyone else is doing it, and become just like a copy paste machine, so to say. Has to be a feeling there. Yeah. Going a little bit throughout the branches. In the tree, I've been told that in the Chinese horoscope, I'm a monkey, so that's what monkeys do. They go throughout the branches, but hopefully, in the same, not losing the last sight of the trunk of what we're talking about. So, yeah, all our faculties are to be, you say, Sarva Padivinir Moktam before, Tat Paratvena Nirmalam, Hrishikena, Hrishikesh, Sevanam Bhakti Rujate. So that's the definition that already existed before Rupa Goswami composed his own. He based his own verse on that verse. You can draw an absolute parallel between these two verses. That verse is Hrishikena Hrishikesh. No, one name of Krishna is the master of all our of the senses, or the master of all our he of all our faculties. All our faculties are to be dedicated to him. So that's the definition of bhakti. You have all this tongue, belly, all the organs, all the dimensions are to become offerings, are not to be cut off from the system, are to be consecrated. Is that in English? Sorry, I like to practice my English with all of you here. So, as we say many times in the beginning, we may not know yet how to engage every single faculty, and sometimes some of our faculties will be put into pause for a moment. Don't, because we don't know what to do with them, and we may need to put them in pause and engage other faculties, but gradually, more and more, we should know how to engage everything in a loving way. Our faculties, all of us connect matter, connect with everything from a place of loving presence, loving dedication. Yeah. True, Kampro, you were raising your hand like 2 hours ago. So
Yes.
you have to say something to Ramachandra Prabhu. You need that we turn down the curtain for you now? Did that for us. So.
That for everybody.
Thank you.
You began, Marge, by talking about the relationship between a hearer and a speaker, or someone who is part of a bigger conversation. And we're all components in that. You are the speaker, we are hearing, but we're also asking questions. the relationship between it. And I was thinking also how we know one of the six loving exchanges between the devotees is revealing one's mind and confidence and listening to one disclose their minds and confidence. That seems very the whole process is relational, and how we are able to kind of unlock the key to greater depths of our of understanding and revelation, that the flow of inspiration that comes from Krishna through the speaker and all that, that's being in that right place, that vulnerable place, willing to actually wear one's heart on the sleeve and be available to be a part of that relationship, so to speak, rather than being reserved and or what am I trying to say? Yeah, just succumbing to the usual tendencies of fear or self-deprecation, or thinking, I don't know anything, I can't say anything, like I don't have any real realization. And sometimes we feel we don't really know what we connect with at any particular time. And other times, depending on the association, we can suddenly everything flows and we can have a very meaningful discussion with people. So how much can you, like in a group setting where we're trying to explore more and more profundity and understand more and more about ourselves, about the path of bhakti, about what's holding us back. It seems that the environment's very, very important for us to allow to overcome those inadequacies, and even if we do, sometimes the environment is such that you don't feel safe in that environment, right? So it seems safety, that safety or that faith in the people that we're interacting with is paramount to actually getting somewhere with that. And it's also not something we can just set aside and say, well, this will go away and I'll just reveal it, will be revealed. It seems the whole process is very tied up with how we are able to interrelate with one another. So how to overcome that those difficulties, how do we find that safe environment? Like you're saying, we can formally establish groups of brotherhood, a sisterhood. We have these things. Sometimes we find impediments even within those established forums to try and go, move ahead because of conditionings or immaturity, where people want to just volunteer advice or judge or so many things. I don't experience that with you, but I know for sure sometimes, just because, and it's not to say that the onus isn't with me, but sometimes it is enough of an impediment to stop me wanting to partake in such an exchange because of the type of immaturity perhaps that is there. Does that make any sense? I'm kind of rattling off about that. Is how do we how do we actually systematically establish meaningful sanghas that will actually be nourishing, and not that we just generalize and think anyone will do, and that doesn't necessarily cut the mustard.
But Thank you. What I will personally say in my own experience and what I've seen is it all begins by personal relationships, one-on-one. It's not like we'll establish like a whole community of perfect people who trust each other. I mean, first you have to be personal. Personal means one-on-one, right? That's why, as you say, began saying describing Rupa Goswami's six loving interactions. Basically, that's his definition of Sadhu Sangha. It's a very one-on-one, reciprocal, loving interaction. He's not speaking about a massive gathering, but start to how you relate on a personal level with everyone in a way that is loving. And you yourself mentioned in the sharing the question that the word safety, which is very important, because Rupa Goswami said, okay, let's reveal our minds, our hearts to each other. But that can only happen if we feel safe enough to do so. You cannot force, okay, guys, you Ramachandra, reveal your mind to him, you to her, you to him. It's not like a forced thing, right? You have to feel safe in order to do that. And if I try to convince you, telling you, no, it's a safe environment here. You are the one to decide that. I cannot decide that for you. So if you don't feel safe, you don't feel safe for whatever reason. I mean, it doesn't mean that the other people are bad, but if you don't feel safe, you cannot just open up. So we have to work on that, the person, the environment, but it cannot be like, come on, guys, be more vulnerable, feel more safe. The more I press that button, the more unsafe you will feel, and you want to run away. So it's a very gradual building up of confidence and trust and safety, and for healthy reasons also, right? It's not that because I may want to make you feel safe for the wrong reasons also. You can manipulate someone by making them feel safe to begin with. And when they feel safe, boom, the wolf appears. So it's not just even about making others feel safe, but discerning your own intentions, why you want to create safety in other person. Because when safety is there, the willingness to open will be there. And when that happens, what you will do with that? Even if you don't have bad intention, do you know how to manage other person's openness? Because that's a delicate situation. If someone opens up, becomes very vulnerable, you don't know what to do with vulnerability. You may have very good intentions, but you may end up trampling on the other person's vulnerability, and the other person will feel, I was abused. Literally. Even though the other person didn't want to abuse, he wanted to genuinely even help the person. But do I know how to handle other people's vulnerability, my own vulnerability? So sometimes, before I want to establish a world-changing community, first question may be like, how I'm dealing with my own vulnerability, for example. No. How can I deal with other people's being vulnerable? Okay. How to create a safe space? And they're all gradual processes, and it's something that builds with time also, right? And it's always reciprocal also, right? It's not like, okay, I'm here to hear everyone's mind being revealed to me, but I won't reveal my mind to anyone. But sometimes also I've seen that happening in some settings, unfortunately, like, without bad intentions. But the Swami or the Guru or the temple president or the whomever authority is the one receiving everyone's situations. And it's too much for one person to receive all that. And on top of that, it's even more too much if that person is not able to disclose his or her own heart to others. It's very disproportionate. And many people eventually burn out or cannot sustain them. So it has to be always reciprocal. I'm giving, but I'm receiving. And that's why Srila Siddharth gave this beautiful, and I will share that here a few times, the beautiful definition of Sadhu Sangha. When someone asked him what Sadhu Sangha, he spoke about, he quote Napoleon. You heard that a few times from me, probably. or from Should I Say the Marriage? He said the Napoleon chair. And everyone was like, what's that? We're talking about Sadasanga here. Napoleon is a non-devotee. So we're talking yesterday. Why are you bringing a non-devotee into the picture? And a chair? What's that? So he said once in battle, Napoleon went with his army. They were at a place where they wouldn't find shelter to spend the night. It was freezing cold, it was snowing. And if they will fall asleep on the ground full of snow, they could basically die during, they will not survive the night. They didn't have a shelter, so what to do? So Napoleon said, okay, I put all his soldiers in standing in a circle. Shall we try it in practice? It may end up in a tragedy. He put all of them in a circle, and he said, when I clap, or whatever he said, you all sit like if there will be a chair behind you. But everyone does the same at the same time. Probably there were a few failed attempts first, but at one point it worked. So everyone sat, and the man behind me was my chair for me. And the man, I was a chair to the man in front of me. And everyone was a chair for someone. And everyone was being chaired by someone. So he said, that's Sadhu Sangha. Right? It's reciprocal. I'm giving support. I'm your chair. But someone's been my chair. I'm being supported. It's always reciprocal. You need help, I'm willing to help you. But I also need help. And many times by helping you, I'm being helped also. No? It's never unidirectional, but yeah, it all begins for yeah. Discerning our intentions and then okay, I want to build community, family, healthy relationships, from which place, how to create safety. And even again, as you say, even if we are creating some degree of safety, because there are so many degrees of that, there may be things happening between people that we know, that we trust in. Doesn't mean that because we have safe space and we may trust each other, doesn't mean that everything will always be smooth. I mean, I have to think about the people that are closest in my life that I've shared with in the most intimate ways and I've lived with the most of my time. Probably they are the ones that I have the most struggle with also sometimes, or the most discussions or conflict, because we happen, I don't know, I'm thinking about a few of them. I lived with them in the ashram for 20 years. So you get to really know the other person in 20 years living together, and know the other person means know everything. The shiny part and the not so shiny part. And in communities, some of that stuff sometimes comes, but because there was enough safety and enough love for each other, we could always sit and talk. And no matter the problem, we always knew that the problem can never be compared with the connection we had and the friendship we have and the affection we have. So all whatever problem we are discussing and we are pissed off about one another, pissed off, whatever. I have problems with the phrasal verbs and all this combination of words. We always knew that's something irrelevant and superficial. We need to talk about it, but it's never on the level of the depth of our connection. But of course, to have the depth of connection, we had to build that from day one to year 20. So, and still going on. Sometimes we may have differences and discussions, and never to any extreme point, but just it's part of life. So also to normalize that in communities, not that everything has to be Hare Krishna. There is friction, there is stuff, even in the spiritual world, they have difference of opinion. So I always like to say, when Yashoda is putting Krishna to bed, she's really wishing, may Krishna have a sound sleep the whole night. That's not what Radha and the gopis want for Krishna. They're waiting for him already. So they have difference of opinion, really, for eternity. They eternally differ in that. They will never agree, and they love each other. So we need to enter into that place where not only okay, we can agree to disagree, but we can love each other while disagreeing. That's, I know it's high level harmony, and that's why we may need to begin with something more basic and foundational. And yeah, it's 101. No, I personally am not so much obsessed with we have to have a 3,000 people communities around the world everywhere. So sometimes let's build community with the person next to me. That's community already. Community means common unity. That's the meaning of the word. Community doesn't mean a crowd. It means if you are 3,000, it's okay as long as you are properly connected. If not, I don't care for the numbers. The numbers may get in the way sometimes. I mean, if you want intimacy, I mean, you cannot be intimate with 3,000 people. I may have to give a lecture sometimes to hundreds of people, but to be honest, I do not relish that much as when I'm with 5, 10, 15, 20, because I can keep personal eye contact. When I'm like with 300, it's like, wow, I cannot look at 300 people at the same time. It's overwhelming. It's okay. I'm grateful for that, but it's another quality of intimacy. So many times we need smaller circles to be able to work on safety, intimacy, vulnerability. We cannot sit in a circle of 200 people and, okay, guys, let's be vulnerable. Say, what is this? And even if we are a few, there has to be safety properly built, and the vulnerability has to come spontaneously, not demanded. So, yeah. And it's 8 p.m., so I don't want to take too much more of your time. We have been sharing almost for 2 hours. And tomorrow we have more one last meeting in the morning. So since a morning meeting, also I don't want to make it too late in case you need to rest and do some things. But we'll be meeting tomorrow at 9 in the morning at Ramachandra's house, just in case, confirming one more time. So next door. And we will continue inviting for any questions, anything you may like to bring. I think we already are in that wave, so let that current continue to flow. So thank you so much for being here, your presence, your questions. Sorry if anything I said caused some discomfort. Life happens, discomfort happens. It's not the intention, but sometimes, yeah, trying to share and talk and speak with one another. We may not always agree, and just for you to relax, I'm not expecting people to come to a lecture of mine and leave the lecture agreeing with 100% everything I say. So there's a flavor in having difference of opinion also, and being able to explore that from a place of joint community, common unity. See you tomorrow for those who are available. For those who are not, thank you so much for coming. A pleasure to meet you all again. Please, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai. Sriram Sankirtan ki jai. Sadhu Sangha ki jai. Gaur Premanand. Vanchakalpataru Vishal. Vasundhu Vaishnave.